We're going to talk to John T. Edge on today's Two-Way Street. He's the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, which is an organization based at the University of Mississippi. It's dedicated to studying and documenting the food cultures of the South. John T. writes for Garden and Gun magazine and the Oxford American, and he's been a contributor to the New York Times and to NPR's All Things Considered. Along the way, he won a prestigious James Beard Foundation Award for distinguished writing. His new book, his publisher says, is a history of the modern South told through its food. John T. Edge, I'm so glad you are here to talk about the Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. Thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
I want to, if we can, the way you walk us through the history of Southern food is so fascinating, and I want to go through some of that, but I'd kind of like to start at the ending and then go backward. Is that fair?
I love that.
One of the last things you say in the book is, the South was once a place that did not brook intrusion. Now it's the region with the highest immigration rates. When I was a boy in 1970s Georgia, a barbecue sandwich and Brunswick stew with soda crackers was my go-to meal. But then you go on and tell us about your family.
Yeah.
Tell us about
that. So we live in Oxford, Mississippi, a college town, a kind of prototypical college town with a courthouse at the center of the square. And you might think that a barbecue joint lurks somewhere on the outskirts of our town, or a fried chicken cafe does, and that's where we go on a Saturday. Like I went to my barbecue joint on Saturday growing up in Georgia. My son and myself and my wife, what we prize on a Saturday afternoon is Taqueria El Mundo, run by new immigrants to Mississippi from Zacatecas. And we get barbecue al pastor with pineapple, pork al pastor with pineapple on tacos. And we get fryer hot chips with queso and Mexican Coke. And that feels as much a part of the place I claim, the South I claim, as did the barbecue sandwiches I grew up on. And that's what my son thinks of as kind of his Saturday food. Just down the street from El Mundo is snack bar. Vish Bhatt is the chef. He's a native of Gujarat, India. And the beautiful thing about his food reminds us of the kind of global South in which we live. He has okra on his menu, which is deeply Southern and deeply Indian at the same time. During the height of the summer, he'll do a boiled peanut chaat. All those dishes kind of connect the origins of plants and the stories of people as they cross borders. They reflect this kind of porous South in which we live today, wherein defining, you know, North and South polarities, saying we live in the South and the Yankees are up here, or we live in the South and that's a place that's isolated from global commerce. Vish's cooking gives a lot of that.
So your son, Jess?
Jess.
Would he call the foods that he's eating, would he think of them as Southern food?
He is very aware of his place in the South. I mean, you know, we live, as I mentioned, in this kind of prototypical town. There's a Confederate memorial straight up in front of the courthouse opposite Square Books. 2 weeks ago, there was a gay pride parade in Oxford. And if you talk about contextualization of monuments in this moment, the most beautiful contextualization I've ever seen was crowds cheering for a gay pride parade in Oxford, standing at the base of the Confederate Memorial. Like, this is a complicated place in which we live. And yet, my son, now 16, recognizes a South and thinks of himself as a Southerner. He is a modern Southerner. He is perhaps less burdened by the two wars that have defined this region for a long time, and yet he embraces his identity as a Southerner.
So, in the conclusion of your book, the other thing you say to us in talking about your son and his heritage is, what was once a region of black and white locked in a struggle for power has become a society of many hues and many hometowns. His generation now weaves new narratives about what it means to be Southern. So let's go back and talk about what being Southern meant to you when you were growing up, if we can.
Sure.
Growing up in Clinton, Georgia. One of the things you tell us in the book is that having grown up in Clinton and then moving to Mississippi, where you majored in Southern studies,
yeah? Yep.
you tell us this. You wanted to reconcile your profound love of the South with the anger that boiled in you when you confronted our peculiar history. That's a theme we hear a lot on this show, John
yeah.
T.
Yeah, of course.
But what does it mean to you as you became a student of, an activist on behalf of, a great lover of Southern foods?
Well, I think that to love a place truly, you have to love it clear-eyed. You have to grapple with the horrors of this place to indulge in the pleasures of this place. Those polarities define my love of this region.
You say this at the beginning of your book. Conversations about food have offered paths to grasp bigger truths about race and identity, gender and ethnicity, subjugation and creativity. Your whole book describes that arc from mid-20th century on, yes?
It does. It does. I mean, if you look at the beginnings of the civil rights movement, you know, when the South begins to change, in 1955, the Montgomery bus boycotts, we have the shining example of an activist who leverages her knowledge of food to change the South in a woman named Georgia Gilmore, who was a cook, a midwife. She literally laid track for the rails. She was a woman of great emotional ferocity and intelligence, and she leveraged the skills she had acquired in kitchens, cooking for white families and cooking for her own black family, to drive the Montgomery bus boycotts, to fuel the Montgomery bus boycotts. Quite literally, she baked cakes and pies and fried chicken, which she sold initially at the very first meeting of Montgomery Improvement Association, wherein Dr. King took the stage and Rosa Parks took a bow and the MIA drove forward. And Georgia Gilmore recognized that if the Montgomery Improvement Association was going to establish an alternate transportation system to ferry the cooks and maids of black Montgomery around town, they would have to have gas for the cars and insurance for the cars. So when we think about this notion of how does food offer us a way to think about racism and its impact, civil rights activism and its promise, there are characters like Georgia Gilmore who bring that story to life in a very kind of people's history sort of way. And I'm proud of having a moment to share her story because I think it's remarkable.
She and her neighbor, Rufus Lewis, cooked together to raise money for the boycott. And she organized the Club from Nowhere, which was local cooks and bakers who came together, among other things, for political messaging. They came together to figure out what the messages that they wanted to take back to their churches and their communities.
Yeah, and that notion, the Club from Nowhere, was a scrim of anonymity that the women grasped for. This notion that we're going to do work under the cover of our club. We will not name who is in it. Georgia Gilmore was the only known member of this club because she stood up in the church to announce how much they had raised that week, and she shouted to the heavens her pride in that. And yet behind her, working in anonymity, were African-American women in the Club from Nowhere. That anonymity also allowed recalcitrant and somewhat supportive whites in Montgomery to buy in by buying a cake or a pie. They too helped drive the bus boycott and fuel the bus boycott.
You know, they could not come forward and publicly say they supported the boycott, but if they did something as innocent as buy a cake,
right?
No one was going to blame them, and at the same time, they were able to help the cause.
Right. Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful conceit.
Yeah. you describe Gilmore. You talk about her as a big woman with a swaggering personality. And as you've already said, the movement leaders ate there, including MLK. What did she call MLK?
What I printed in the book is that she called him Heifer. I mean, but think about the intimacy that offered.
Exactly.
At a moment when everyone was up in King's business. They were praising him as the savior of Montgomery, and yet he adjourned to her kitchen where he was treated like family. You know, that kind of joshing and needling that we offer to those people we love was an expression of fidelity and camaraderie.
We should also say that what came out of the boycott was sort of the first beginnings of what you talk about, which is black house restaurants. Yeah?
Yeah, I remember when I lived in Atlanta, I used to go to Annie Keith's just down the street from here. And Annie Keith's was the sort of place where you walked in the front door, you ate this bounteous fried chicken and pole bean and fried corn lunch. And then after you finished your meal, you stepped to the back and returned your tray, you returned your plate.
Literally in a house.
Literally in a house, in a bungalow house just down on Ralph McGill from this studio. That sort of house restaurant, which is comparable in Cuba. Today, as Cuba opens up to American tourism, people go looking for paladares, which are house restaurants of Cuba. These are part of the informal economy. And in the civil rights movement years, Georgia Gilmore's house becomes that kind of restaurant, that kind of clubhouse restaurant where people gather to plot strategy. You know, it functions similarly to Pascal's in Atlanta is a formalized version of that. The informal version is Georgia Gilmore's house where at an oak trestle table, the civil rights movement gathers to salve their wounds and to plot the next movement.
What were you eating when you went to have these dinners down by Ralph McGill?
When I was going to Annie Keith's, I would get fried cornbread. I would get collard greens. I would get black-eyed peas. I oftentimes wanted a four-vegetable lunch instead of the fried chicken or the pork chop, and I still like that. Instead of a meat and three, I like a four. But it's the same era, like when I lived here, I was going to Deacon Burton's, too, in Inman Park. You know, famously, Deacon Lytle Burton was, John Lewis brought him to D.C. to celebrate his first election. You know, those restaurants mattered deeply as kind of early integrated spaces in the South, too, where black and white came together.
You just said something that I think is really important. And I hope you won't mind, at least through part of our conversation, I'd kind of like to share with you my experience of Southern food and get your reaction to it.
I'd love to
know.
And
this is an example of that. I moved to Atlanta in the fall of 1983 from Chicago, which was and continues to be one of the most segregated cities in the United States. Blacks and whites don't intermingle very much in the city of Chicago. They still don't. And Deacon Burton's is one of the first places, of course, on my list of must-go restaurants because its fried chicken was legendary. And the first time I walked into Deacon Burton's, being a Chicago boy, I was blown away by the fact it wasn't just that blacks and whites sat next to each other at tables. It was the black and white and vast differences in economic status.
Right. It was about class as well as race.
It was the it could be a maintenance man next to a corporate executive from Georgia Power, whites and blacks. And I was struck by how Deacon Burton's brought those people together.
You know, that restaurant, I read it the same way and kind of reveled in that when I went there. That restaurant felt like a living, breathing embodiment of the beloved community ideals that the movement preached. And I remember the first time I went in there, and he may have done this for you. I don't know if you remember this, but if you were a first-time customer, he had a little miniature version of the Liberty Bell up on the counter, and he would sing song out something like, "Here comes a boy with old knock knees. We're going to feed him some black-eyed peas," you know? And that chef's toque that he wore on top of his head went, kind of impossibly high in my memory. And that kind of skein of grease that would kind of float over the room, you'd see the white top of his chef toque poking up over that. There was such promise in that restaurant. You know, one of the reasons I think we as Southerners and we as Americans are fascinated with restaurants is they promise something more than just sustenance. They promise community as well. And Deacon Burton's and Annie Keith's were, in the 1970s especially, when the South realized it was a busted-ass place and then thought it was going to reconcile, thought we were going to integrate our schools, thought there was great progress ahead, those restaurants were places to apprehend the possibilities for the South and integrated possibilities for the South.
I want to pick up, too, on your talking about the way in which movement leaders during the bus boycott all gathered at the Gilmore House to eat. One of the other places, of course, that I got to know really well when I first arrived here was Pascal's Restaurant and Motor Inn down on MLK. Mr. Pascal was another giant in his industry. And it was so moving to me to realize that it was in those back meeting rooms at Pascal's that Dr. King and Ralph Abernathy and John Lewis, Andy Young, this was where they held their strategy sessions as they planned what to do in the movement.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Pascal's functioned that way for you across the street. Alex Barbecue Heaven functioned that way for me. I also remember that in the back booth, there was a plaque that said, in essence, Dr. King ate ribs here. And that public recollection of King's presence at Pascal's, at Alex, was really important because it reminds us, again, of the role that restaurants played in the movement and the very human nature of someone like King. Like, you know, the idea that he was in that booth gnawing ribs connects you to him. You know, we all eat.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with Southern Foodways Alliance director and award-winning writer, John T. Edge. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, my guest is John T. Edge. He writes about Southern food and culture, and he's the recipient of a prestigious James Beard Foundation Award for distinguished writing. We're talking about his new book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. As we pick up, I asked John T. to talk about a famous feud that erupted in Georgia over the correct way to eat cornbread with potlicker.
So in 1931, we're in the height of the Depression. We're not drinking. You know, the Volstead Act is in place. And Huey Long and Julian Harris. So Julian Harris, at this point, was an editor at the Atlanta Constitution. He's the son of Joel Chandler Harris, the interpreter of the Uncle Remus tales. Huey Long is senator, U.S. senator-elect from Louisiana. And Long sells some bonds to an investment group and attributes the sale of bonds to a meal of potlicker and cornbread that he served them. And he was crowing about it. And Harris takes offense, and they begin to the way that Huey described eating his corn pone and potlicker. And they begin this debate that is fanciful, that is diversionary from the politics of the time, that is diversionary from the economic problems of the time. They begin this debate over the relative merits of dunking or crumbling cornbread into potlicker. And it takes absurd heights. There's a beautiful poem that I found. There are playlets that I found. I published the poem in the book.
People arguing about which is the preferred way.
Which is the preferred way to eat cornbread. The beautiful thing about it, though, and it's it reflects the possibilities of writing about food is that people began writing in to the editor of the Constitution, voicing their views about cornbread and pot liquor and the way to eat it. But they end up writing about racism. They end up writing about gender politics. They end up writing about regional identity. They write about everything.
Here again, right. The connection of food to social issues that are on the minds of the people of the region.
Right.
Okay, so another personal story. In 1983, I was starting to cover the Georgia State Legislature. I was invited to go to a Saturday lunch with the Speaker of the House at that point, Thomas B. Murphy, mm-hmm. the legendary Speaker, yeah. and a number of the other leaders of the legislature. They all said, we're going to go to Harold's Barbecue down by the Atlanta Federal Prison, no longer there. And when we arrived, they all ordered, and you'll immediately understand this, they all ordered a big platter of cracklin' cornbread. You point out, by the way, that cracklin' cornbread just doesn't get made the way it used to. What is cracklin' cornbread?
So cracklin' cornbread is the crunchy bits. It is the fat rendered with the skin still attached to the point where you get these of the pig. Forgive me. I mean, it was assumed it was pig.
So they ordered a big platter of cracklin' cornbread and then big tall glasses of buttermilk. And as I sat there, you know what they did, don't you? What did they do with the
crumbled.
And put it into the buttermilk and took our iced teaspoons and stirred it up. And in that moment, watching these men all around me doing that, I thought, where the hell have I landed?
but what does that remind you of today? Like, what is the food craze that reminds you of today?
You tell me.
Like smoothies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a country boy smoothie. It's a country come to town boy. You know, at the point when, you know, we still had the county unit system in Georgia and those legislators ran the state. You know, that's they're bringing their country boy or they're reclaiming their country roots at Harold's by drinking those country boy smoothies.
What is pot liquor? Yeah, it is the title of your book,
it is.
Obviously. So what is it?
So pot liquor, there's a metaphorical and there's a substantive answer to your question. The substantive answer to your question is, you know, pot liquor is the liquid at the bottom of the pot. After you've cooked your greens with a hunk of side meat, after you've cooked your beans with a trotter, the liquid essence at the bottom of the pot, the leavings at the bottom of the pot, where, in fact, the nutrients reside, that is pot liquor. And during the days of enslavement, especially when cooking greens, the slave masters would often take the greens and leave the liquor for the enslaved, not knowing that the nutrients resided in that liquor. There's a subversive beauty in that. And then the metaphorical piece is that, you know, pot liquor is the boil down essence of the South. You take the scraps, you take the farm fresh greens, and you boil it down. And what I've attempted to do is boil down 60 years of the South. And the liquor at the bottom is what I serve up.
You tell us in the book that you first tasted pot liquor at a restaurant right here in Atlanta, a famous restaurant. Yeah. Where?
Mary Mac's. Mary Mac's, you know. I may have had pot liquor at the bottom of a pot before, but Mary Mac's was the first place I went where you got a cup of pot liquor and a side of cornbread. So at Mary Mac's, it was a cup of pot liquor. It was a small pone of cornbread. And I came to love that as lunch. And then later, I came to see that as metaphor and had the opportunity to lunch there with Lester Maddox.
Tell us about that. I wanted to hear about your lunch with Lester Maddox.
So I became, as you know, I was writing for the Oxford American. I still continue to write for that magazine. And the magazine always published a music issue, still does. And, you know, I had to figure out each year, like, okay, so if they're publishing a music issue, how can I write about food and music at the same time? And coming across the story of Lester Maddox and Bobby Fears, who toured the South as the governor and the dishwasher, Mr. Fears, who had performed with the Ohio players who had done jail time for drug possession, whom Maddox brought out of jail and who began working for Maddox at his underground Atlanta restaurant. Bobby Fears and he conceived a kind of nighttime comedy and variety act, The Governor and the Dishwasher, and Fears would have a ketchup and mustard splattered coat, and it was minstrelly to the nth degree. And so I knew about this moment. I was fascinated with this moment, and I wanted to interview Maddox about it. And the way I coaxed him out of his house was to say, I'll buy you lunch at Mary Max. And Maddox, you know, Maddox played it to the hilt. He showed up for our lunch with one of his Lester Maddox wristwatches on his arm. He stopped outside after lunch to do deep knee bends to prove his virility to me. He never stepped out of character.
You tell us about another interesting combination, black and white. Zephyr Wright and Lyndon B. Johnson. Who is Zephyr Wright? And why was she important, really, to Lyndon Johnson as he fought as president for civil rights?
So Zephyr Wright was the family cook for the Johnson administration, a Texas native herself. When Johnson moved to D.C., she came with, and so did her husband. As Johnson picked up the Kennedy baton and began hectoring and persuading and cajoling toward the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 64, he realized that he needed to make this more personal. You know, the kind of big picture politics were hard for people to grapple. He wanted to make his arguments about civil rights more personal. So he began telling stories, and he varied them slightly over time, depending on his audience. But he told stories of the injustices that Zephyr Wright, his African-American cook, suffered on the roadways of the South. You know, he told stories of, you know, the Johnson family, including Miss Wright, stopping at a rest station or at a gas station to use the restroom. And Johnson and everyone gets back in the car, and 15 minutes later, Miss Wright says, you know, may we pull over and let me go in the bushes because I need to use the restroom. And he's flabbergasted and angry and is like, why in the hell do we need to stop now? We just stopped. She said, you know, I can't use the restroom there. And these were moments, these were small epiphanies for Johnson, but they were also great political opportunities for him because he could make this very personal. He could help people think through what would happen if they were in a situation, in a similar situation. Would they be similarly angry?
Do we have any idea what Zephyr Wright used to cook for LBJ?
We know that she was a great manager of his diet. We know that she was concerned about his weight. and we know that he liked the country foods on which he was raised in Texas. There's a gentleman named Adrian Miller who wrote a great book about presidential foodways. And if you want to dig into what she cooked, I recommend his book.
All right. What's very moving is that Zephyr Wright was at his side when he signed, I don't know, it was Voting Rights Act or one of his
initials. It was the Civil Rights Act of 64. It was the Civil Rights Act of 64.
She was right there at the desk.
Yeah, he literally, as Johnson signs, he hands one of the first pens to Zephyr Wright and credits her. He knows because he's used her story. He's used her life to further black rights in America. And she was proud and he was proud. He knew the power of those narratives.
As we move, as we start to kind of move toward more contemporary Southern cooking, I want to ask you something that I found fascinating about your book. I always think of the farm-to-table movement as being a relatively recent development in food. When a Hugh Atchison, Hugh's been on this show a number of times.
Just saw him
yesterday. Always talk about how well Hugh was one of the first. But in fact, you tell us that you go back to Edna Lewis, Paul Prudhomme in New Orleans. These people were all aware that locally sourced foods were going to make them better chefs.
Yeah.
So it's not a new movement.
It's not. And like, you know, we have a tendency to situate farm to table. If we're not situating it in Georgia, if we're not thinking about Hugh, we're thinking somehow about Berkeley and Alice Waters, you know, and the great provender which would show up at the back door of Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. And yet, if you talk to Alice Waters about who inspired her, she quickly begins telling stories of Edna Lewis, a native of Freetown, Virginia, you know, a woman who was born on Thomas Jefferson's birthday, a woman whose kind of respect for and kind of devotion to farm-to-table ideals was really the beginning of the American food movement, I would argue. But we don't frame her that way. We tend to want to frame it with Berkeley and Brooklyn, and that's unfair to Miss Lewis's legacy.
And yet she is beginning to be recognized more and more, I think, today. She truly is one of the great chefs of America.
Well, and what she did was she told stories of her upbringing in Freetown, and she rhapsodized about you know, the virtues of fresh picked greens. She rhapsodized about a chicken in the spring when she said chickens in the spring tasted better than chickens in the fall. Like these gradations of difference and this belief in the possibilities of the land at a time in the 1970s when, remember, we're still talking about this moment when blacks have quit the land, blacks are leaving the land. Edna Lewis said, no, look here, understand there's value here. Small holding farms are deeply important. And so many people were inspired by her book, A Taste of Country Cooking. You know, it's a 1976 moment. It's a moment when America is rediscovering itself. Roots is coming out. The bicentennial is hitting. And Edna Lewis becomes this, she becomes this kind of spokesperson for the virtues of agriculture. Yeah. And she does it in a very personal way.
And as I point out too, Paul Prudhomme, same thing down in New Orleans. He started out at really establishing himself at Commander's Palace,
right,
but then really made his name at K. Paul, which was the restaurant he opened with his wife, right?
Right.
And Prudhomme talks about, I could never figure out why a potato. Tell that story.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about cooking at Commander's Palace and other gigs, and he talks about tasting potatoes and realizing that the problem, like he wasn't satisfied with what he cooked, is the problem was they've been too long out of the ground. The potatoes he grew up eating were ones that were fresh dug. His mother was his inspiration. For, you know, previous generations of chefs, the inspiration had been France. People were looking to France for their kind of culinary epiphanies. They were thinking about Julia Child. And Paul Prudhomme said, no, where I am inspired is my mama and her people in Opelousas, Louisiana. What Prudhomme did beautifully was he connected kind of Cajun country and New Orleans. He said, New Orleans can be the grand showplace for Cajun cuisine, and together we can fomate this kind of a Louisiana style of cookery.
So if you stood in line for an hour, 2 hours to get inside K. Paul, if you were lucky to get in,
right,
he might serve you a great plate of crawfish etouffee, for example.
Right. I mean, he said those foods had value, and he also was so playful about it. You know, he called fried crawfish tails popcorn.
Yeah.
He was a great showman. He understood marketing. He was one of the first celebrity chefs and also introduced what we now think of as pop-up dinners. He was the first person to kind of do that on a broad scale, too.
We're going to take another break right now. More with John T. Edge coming up. And when we come back, the story of Colonel Sanders. He started out to popularize authentic Southern fried chicken, but it all went downhill quickly. Thank you. Let's get back to my conversation with author and Southern Foodways Alliance director John T. Edge. We've been talking about legendary chefs of the South, but there's one we've left out. Okay, as long as we're talking about larger-than-life figures, and to take on another subject that you addressed in the book, which is the commercialization of traditional Southern food, let's talk about Colonel Sanders. I was shocked, stunned, when I read about Harlan Sanders. If you don't mind, share just a little first of the story of how he became a chicken king and then what happened.
I mean, there are many ways Colonel Sanders shocks. Colonel Sanders had a foul mouth. Colonel Sanders, Corbin, Kentucky is where he begins his business, a roadside business. He improves fried chicken, and that was the way we talked about such things in that moment in the late 1960s, early 1970s. He improved fried chicken by finding a way to cook it more quickly, pressure fried chicken. And in doing that, he built a model that could be replicated. And as Sanders traveled literally in his car with a pressure fryer in the back, he sold restaurants on adopting his model. And he grew his business and he grew his business, and finally he sells his business, cashes in. And when he cashes in and sells to a corporation, and the corporations flip it and flip it and flip it, Sanders gets increasingly agitated because they have ruined his chicken. He called it, a damn dough ball on a drumstick. he cursed profligately and beautifully.
At one point, the company that took over tried to market a barbecued chicken, right?
Yeah.
And you quote him, the colonel, in talking to a young man who apparently who was serving it somewhere, I guess, he said, "That barbecued chicken, that's a bunch of shit."
Yeah. He didn't. But I think what happened, and here's what he said about the gravy. How do you serve this goddamn slop? With a straw? He was angry, and I think the reason he was angry is he realized he was complicit in the kind of subverting of the tradition that he was now the inheritor of, the keepsake or of. That's not a good word. I don't know what the hell the word should be. But he realized that his role in modernizing Southern food, in delivering this hyper-traditional food to a new, modern, urban Southerner, that he had been he was part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Whether it was the first iteration when he was first making it or as it exists today, what would you say about Kentucky Fried Chicken?
I'm not here to dismiss Kentucky Fried Chicken. Okay. I haven't eaten the stuff in, I don't know, maybe a decade.
Okay, that's all right.
But what I'm interested in is the way in which Kentucky Fried Chicken is a modern Southern business selling hyper-traditional Southern foods. It's worth study. It's worth understanding. And that business, Kentucky Fried Chicken, the success of that business, there were rumors swirling early on after Sanders sold that his secretary was worth $3 million. That kind of American success story and the promise of what a business can do was so much a part of the American story in that moment that he inspired a range of others. And one of the great stories that come out of this book is Mahalia Jackson's fried chicken system. So in the early 1970s, a group of white businessmen partnered with Benjamin Hooks when he was president of the Southern Christian Leadership Council. Benjamin Hooks and Mahalia Jackson, two great black figures of that moment, partner with white businessmen. They say this is a business arrangement. This is a business arrangement of partnership, not plantationship. They knew exactly what they were doing. Took white money, and the idea was to build black capital, build black jobs. And Mahalia Jackson's fried chicken system, which began in Memphis, Tennessee, was the spread across the country. Didn't quite work out that way.
And neither did Minnie Pearl's fried chicken. She tried the same thing.
Minnie Pearl came first. Mahalia Jackson came second.
Did they fail for similar reasons? Wait, maybe that's not fair. Let's take, why did Mahalia Jackson's fail? Was it a business model problem? Was it a food problem?
There was hubris in these fried chicken chains. They believed that they could sell the personalities, Minnie Pearl, the kind of homespun woman with the hat on her head and the price tag hanging. That she called this would be Howdylicious fried chicken. Mahalia Jackson said this is glorified chicken. Those were words that they didn't coin but were put in their mouths to sell the fried chicken. It was about hubris. You know, they believed that those two personalities would sell the birds, and they didn't believe or didn't spend enough time thinking about how to deliver great fried chicken and great service to people.
You make the point that I thought was really interesting, but it makes sense. You make the point that many Southern chefs had to leave the South before they were able to appreciate the food of the South. What does that mean?
Well, that's tied back up into something we talked about earlier, this you love your place and you're deeply angry at this place. You've got to gain some perspective on this place where you grew up. You've got to step away to see the value in it. And so many chefs... Bill Neal from Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill has an epiphany in France. Frank Stitt from Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham, Alabama. Both those restaurants opened in 1982, Highlands and Crook's, and are still kind of the standard bearers for new Southern cuisine. Both those young white chefs stepped out of the South, saw new value in their region from the perspective of France. And that was a pretty common model back then.
Yeah. So let's talk about there is an overarching theme to your book, and by picking out individual stories, I'm not sure I've done it justice.
No, I'm glad you see a theme though, because it's a big sprawling book.
Well, so I want to talk in the time that we have remaining about some of the themes that I see. First of all, you quote James Villis, who is who?
So James Villis was a North Carolina-born writer about all things culinary. He was a contemporary of Craig Claiborne's, deeply important in the 1970s. He was a bit of an irascible and very smart critic and thinker about food.
And you quote him as saying, America has many regional foods, but there is no coherent national one. And if I read your book correctly, you agree with that and celebrate that in many ways.
I mean, yes. And another way I might answer that, though, is that America does have a national food and it's Southern food.
Okay. Why?
Because, well, a whole bunch of different damn reasons. But, the America has long isolated its problems in the South. America has long identified and celebrated the creative processes of the South, whether that's jazz music or literature of Faulkner or Zora Neale Hurston. America has long looked to the South as this incubator of Americanness, and we've delivered. Our food is deeply embedded with narratives, and I think what we respond to in Southern food is not necessarily how crunchy the chicken is or how smoky the barbecue is. It is instead that the narratives embedded in Southern food culture are what resonates.
Well, can I offer an example?
Yeah, please.
Hugh Atchison, of course, who's from Canada, but he has embraced.
Hugh is an active Southerner. He's claimed this place and done it
beautifully.
Absolutely. Yeah.
When he discovered Carolina gold rice, mm-hmm. he knew he had to embrace it because to him, it allowed him to tell a story about the history of slaves and the Gullah people because that was their rice. And to this day, he will tell you he serves it because it's a part of a history of this region.
Well, and that, Hugh is a great example, and you could extend that example down the state from Athens, and you could show up in Savannah, Georgia. My favorite restaurant in that city right now is called The Gray. And Mashama Bailey, the chef.
This is Savannah.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So Savannah, Georgia, Mashama Bailey is the chef at The Gray. That restaurant is set in a former segregated Greyhound bus station. And Mashama Bailey, an African-American woman who made her bones at Prune Restaurant in New York, a really talented chef. Mashama Bailey is in charge of not one, but two lunch counters. You think about Mashama, whose grandmother's from Forsyth, Georgia. Mashama commands those lunch counters. Those lunch counters where her grandmother would not have been able to take a seat and order a simple club sandwich. So to eat at the Gray now is to commune with that history and to accept the kind offer of a server who comes by and says, would you like to try this roasted eggplant with a kind of spicy peanut relish with origins in West Africa? Like, the whole of the narrative comes together in a restaurant like the Gray in Savannah, only about a 7-minute walk from Paula Deen's restaurant, with another narrative spinning.
Yeah. So let's talk just a little, as we come to a close, about the evolution of the food here. Let's bring it right up to date. Sean Brock in Charleston and in Nashville has set a marker for how Southern chefs are treating their traditions but moving it forward, I think it's fair to say. At the same time, you have a Todd Ginsburg, who's become an extraordinarily successful chef here by taking New York deli food and figuring out a way to interpret it through the lens of what he's learned about being in the South. You have a Billy Allen at Cakes and Ale who does farm-to-table kinds of I mean, we have all of these forces at work right here in our community in Atlanta. What are the best chefs cooking today? What's the interpretation of Southern food today? And how different is it from what we started talking about, which was the 1950s when it was black-eyed peas and pork chops and gravy?
There are two things happening in the South. There is an ongoing and, I think, long arc of rediscovery of our roots, of traditional foodways of the South. You know, someone like David Shields, who's a really beautiful, smart writer who published a recent book called Southern Provisions that digs deep into the agricultural record and helps us glean what was actually grown, what was cooked, who did the cooking, you know, in the 1800s and 1900s in the South. Beautifully done research. And chefs will, for the next 20 years, interpret that research in fine dining restaurants and other places. At the same time, there's another parallel track running, and it is diversification and multiculturalism. And I see that in the cooking of Buford Highway. The chefs of Buford Highway step beyond that border. I think about Hugh Fawn, who has Crawfish Shack up on Buford Highway, you know, set behind his father's auto repair place. And I think about Hugh Fawn, who just opened Bon Ton here in Midtown Atlanta, wherein he's interpreting Vietnamese Southern foods in really broad and modern ways. The South in which I live, the South I embrace, the South I write about here, accommodates both those tracks. And we should, I think, be thankful for those parallel tracks running.
Which brings us full circle to how you end your book. Jess, your son Jess's generation, now weaves new narratives about what it means to be Southern, about what it takes to claim this place as their own.
And how honest we're willing to be when we take a seat at the table. Like, are we open to the true stories of this region? Do we believe that those will make our meal experience deeper and more profound? I think so. We need to know those stories. We need to embrace the tragedy and the triumph of the South. It makes our experience here, our lives here, richer and better.
Given time to reconcile the mistakes my generation made with the beauty we forged amid adversity, his generation might challenge the region of our birth to own up to its promise. John T. Edge, your book is The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. Thank you so much for being here. You just tell great stories, and it's a real pleasure to have you in the Two-Way Street studio.
It's my pleasure. You know, returning to my home state and having a smart conversation is the greatest gift I could get.
We've posted more information about John T. Edge, his new book, and about the Southern Foodways Alliance on our website at gpb.org/TWS, or you'll find it on our Facebook page. That's about all the time we have for today's show. Remember, if you can't be near the radio when we're on the air, you can subscribe to the Two Way Street podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And all of our shows are archived on our website at gpb.org/TWS. Our senior producer is Jenny Amond. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. And our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening today. See you again next week for another Two-Way Street.